Enjoying Opera. Program 3. The Singer, Not the Song.
Placido Domingo as Verdi's Otello, subduing the orchestra. That's what we talked about in the last program, the voice subduing the orchestra, to some, the very essence of opera. One of the people we spoke to even called it a kind of miracle, something you might think was impossible, and yet achieved night after night in opera houses round the world. We talked about the vulnerability of the voice, which is partly what gives the performance in the opera house its tension and excitement. There's a greater uncertainty about the voice than about any other musical instrument, and its failure can be more conspicuous. At the end of the last program, we began to talk a little about the singer himself, and it's to the singer we return today. How do singers live with the tension? What are the demands made on them, and are the demands greater today than in the past? Why, indeed, do they do it at all if it's so difficult and so nerve-wracking, which it certainly is?
It's difficult to live with a voice, you know. It's a very, very jealous wife. If you don't take care of it, if you don't pamper her, you don't take really very... You have to treasure your voice, really, because it's something that otherwise is not there. It's not like any other kind of instrument. You live with it, so everything affects your emotional state, digestion. Whatever you eat, you know, it's worse to sing sometimes with a stomach pain than with a cold. Sometimes you can manage to sing with a cold, but stomach pain is more difficult. You cannot support.
Placido Domingo, the voice not quite so extended there as when he's singing Otello. Bearing all this in mind, listen once again to his Otello. He's joined now by baritone Cheryl Milnes. Placido Domingo and Cheryl Milnes bringing down the curtain on the second act of Verdi's Otello. And, no doubt, whenever they sing it before an audience, bringing the house down too. Many singers will tell you of the strains involved. Marilyn Schaal, for instance, a soprano who specialises in energetic, dramatic roles. She took time off to talk to us in the middle of a busy rehearsal schedule.
It is very hard work physically. Physically, it is extremely demanding. If you don't take care of yourself and if you're not in good physical shape, it becomes practically an insurmountable problem. I know that I have had days where I felt so tired and the air pressure's perhaps been low and it's raining and you feel awful and I feel awful and everybody feels tired. And I drag myself to the theater and I slap the makeup on and I think, I can't do it tonight. I just can't. And somehow, about 5 minutes before I go on, that feeling goes away, and I can do it. Now, I do remember some performances where the feeling remained, and it was a terrible ordeal to have to even breathe in, and much less breathe out and produce a noise along with it.
Marilyn Schaal. The strains today possibly are greater than ever before. Once upon a time, if you can imagine such a time, there were no jet planes. Think of what the jet plane alone means to singers. More performances to be fitted in, constantly having to adjust to new places, abrupt changes of climate and air, just the time changes alone and their effect on meals and digestion, which can play such havoc with the voice, as Placido Domingo was saying. Before the jet plane, most singers, and even the very top ones, spent a large part of the working year as members of a permanent company, a kind of family. Caruso spent 6 months of every year in New York with the Metropolitan Opera. And when they did travel, it was a leisurely train ride or a sea voyage. It's often said that, unlike the singers of today, they didn't tend to wear themselves out so much. Well, they couldn't.
My dear darling, what was there for them to do in those days? They had nothing to do. It isn't like today, where you have 1,000... You can fill up every half an hour of your 12 hours during the day with something to do in this modern world. They had nothing to do but sit at home and do needlework.
Well, the women among them, anyway. That was Dame Maggie Tate, a much-loved singer of an earlier generation, reminiscing about the old days, and perhaps exaggerating the extent to which busy people like Caruso sat around doing nothing. But there are extra strains today, and there's so much demanded of singers, acting as well as singing. They're supposed to look the part too, if possible. Those who meet all the demands and who reach the top and stay there for any length of time have to be people with unusual talent, resilience, and motivation. And yet some people tend to think of the opera star as some sort of overpaid, pampered darling. It's true some of the great singers of the past did have a rather opulent lifestyle, villas, entourage, and all the rest. But then, as now, the daily reality for all of them has been hour after hour of sheer hard work. And it's also worth pointing out that their position has, if anything, been eroded over the years. There was a time when the singer was far more central to the whole operatic enterprise than he is today, more important in some ways even than the composer. At one time, the singer was not only allowed to embellish and improvise, he was expected to. Singers had their own arrangements of a particular number, just like they do in popular music today.
As the nighttime came, with sirens in a row, never make the trip up to Harlem driving, shiny Lincolns in port. She won't miss the dirt with the rest of those broads. That's why this chick is a tramp.
Like the sweet fresh rain in my face, diamonds and lace, no God.
Frank Sinatra, of course, and then Ella Fitzgerald. Singing The Lady is a Tramp by, well, it doesn't matter so much who originally wrote it. It's the singer who counts more than the composer. And so it was once, to some extent, in opera. But since the late 18th and early 19th centuries, composers have expected their work to be sung much more as written, with only relatively minor embellishments. The composer rules. So too, since the early years of this century at least, does the conductor, whom we'll have more to say about later in the series. Another potentate nowadays, as we'll also see later on, is the opera producer. It is perhaps hard to take in, since the top singers do get a fair measure of acclaim, that nonetheless the singer's role, relatively, is not quite as important as it was. Before cinema, before there were film stars, it was often musical virtuosi, and this included opera singers, who caught the public's imagination. And the top opera singers certainly used to be paid far more than their equivalents today, more like today's pop stars, in fact. 100 years ago, Adelina Patti used to average $3,000 a performance, going up sometimes as high as five. Nowadays, the money is more evenly spread, the chorus and orchestra getting proportionately far more, the solo singers less. The lucky few might still get the sort of fee Patti used to get on paper, but take into account inflation in the last 100 years, which reduces it to a fraction, and Patti didn't have the same trouble with income tax. Still, for the top few, the money isn't bad. The singer is still important. Has to be.
I'm sure the singer is a crucial part of one's enjoyment of opera. I mean, an absolutely crucial, central, sovereign part of it. Oh, I think the singer is.
Lord Harwood, Managing Director of English National Opera.
I think that there are certainly well-known singers today who would keep me out of the opera house, and do. And there are other very well-known singers of today who would take me in, whatever was happening. I think I would now make expeditions to catch a new role of Placido Domingo that he hasn't done before or that he hasn't brought to this kind of level before, because it seems to me that we're going to talk about Domingo in the kind of way we talked about Callas, and I used to make those expeditions, not enough, I wish I'd made more, and in the sort of way that people talked about Caruso, about Chaliapin. Did you hear, did you see them do that? And to miss Domingo doing it, it seems to me that he's perhaps the one nowadays that I would say it of. To miss it is to miss something genuinely valuable.
One new role Domingo will be working on, and no doubt Lord Harwood will want to be there to hear him, is Wagner's Lohengrin, an unusual role for Domingo, who doesn't often sing German opera. And it's not quite true, actually, to say that it's an entirely new role for him, as he did sing a few performances of Lohengrin back in the 1960s, when he made this record. Placido Domingo as Wagner's Lohengrin. Daniel Snowman, when he talked to Domingo, asked him, how do you go to work on a role that you're not yet really familiar with?
I sit down at the piano and I try to play all the score of the music. I do admit I listen to recordings, you know. Many musicians, they say they never do it. I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
If there's a recording, you're bound.
If there is a recording, you listen to it. You listen to it, even if it's for a guide, even if it's for something to learn not to do. Let's see. But you have to be humble enough to admit then you listen to them. Because we all need, you know, for preparation. And actually, after I sit down and I play the score, the whole score, and then I see how my part fits into the whole opera, and finally I sit down and I start to study my part.
But you're not singing at all,
are you? No, I start studying it in a way that little by little the music and the text start to make sense, you know? Mm. And then later on I start to sing.
In a way, he's doing three people's jobs: the coach and the accompanists, as well as the singers. But Domingo has unusual musicianship, which is why he can do a fourth person's work too. Although, of course, he'll no doubt be with us for many more years, he's also developing a second career as a conductor. And in the next programme, we'll hear him talking about conducting. A great deal goes into performing a major role. Perhaps only a singer performing at the level of a Domingo or a Callas knows just how much. If the public sees the finished performance, they can only imagine the years of training and the many, many hours of work as the singer learns a role and perfects it before going on stage with it. After all that, only false modesty could prevent a singer knowing his value. As Lord Harwood said, the singer is an absolutely crucial, central, sovereign part of an operatic performance. There's a story about Maria Callas, maybe it's a made-up one, but she was criticized for demanding more to sing Bellini's Norma than the President of the United States was earning. Well, then let him sing it, was her answer.
see, one of the curious things about Carlos's voice, even when I first heard her, was that she produced certain sounds that I used to describe as she sounds as if she's singing into a bottle. And it wasn't until we got to know each other and went to throat specialists together that I started looking into her mouth and throat, and to my astonishment, she has an upper palate of almost Gothic shape, instead of Romanesque. Unlike any other mouth I've ever seen. It goes up like a church steeple.
Callas earning her large fee as Bellini's Norma. To be a singer, you do have, of course, to have some kind of a voice to start with, enough at any rate to be worked up into a usable instrument for the operatic stage. But it certainly took more than a particular formation of the roof of her mouth to make her Maria Callas, though, as impresario Walter Legg said, that church steeple formation did help account for the special kind of sound she sometimes produced. Physiognomy is a part of it. But always assuming the potential, what is it drives someone to become an opera singer? We talked to voice teacher Esther Salomon about this, and she thought back over the many singers she has helped over the years. Some, perhaps, turned to singing in the first place because other forms of expression were blocked.
They are very shy people and long to have some kind of physical outlet. Emotional, physical outlet. Not necessarily a sexual outlet, but some other kind of creative, physical outlet. And you get this very strongly felt in teenagers who are just beginning to grow into emotional feelings and don't quite know how to handle this. Some of them get very religious at this time. And some of them combine their religious feelings with their singing and can make a rather good job of that in their churches and so on. This happens quite often with the very young. And sometimes it's the parents who are pushing them. They don't quite know why they're there.
Esther Salomon. Marilyn Schau, whom we heard talking before about how exhausting it can all be once you are there, has definite ideas about what for her is now the main drive.
And I think I've probably been driven by the search for perfection, the trying to be able finally at some point to do a performance of which I could have been really proud to say to a group of people, an entire audience, here, this is the best I can do with this, what I've got to work with, and I hope you like it. And I think the main reason for performing of any type is to bring pleasure to people, and hopefully through singing I can do that for one or two.
In Musetta's waltz song from Puccini's La Bohème, a 1982 performance at Covent Garden, filmed by the National Video Corporation. Singing the part, acting the part, and looking the part too. A common stereotype of the singer, at any rate for those who don't like opera, is a fat lady, some 20-ton soprano, bawling inanities. And a little strutting, barrel-chested tenor, not exactly pouring sweet nothings into her ear, because he's simply not tall enough to reach that high. But is that fair to many of the present-day opera singers?
Well, I better not mention names. There are one or two exceptions. But by and large, the singers today look as good as they sing, I would say.
Music critic Alan Blythe. Several names came easily to mind, just among the sopranos alone.
take Valerie Masterson or Josephine Bastow, and Kotrobash, one believes in her as Gilda, or as Manon, and Kiri Te Kanawa.
In Mozart's Marriage of Figaro is one of the great elegant ladies of opera and one of Kiri Te Kanawa's finest roles.
A very believable person on stage, as well as being very believable as a singer. And I think this is something where we are much better off, much, much better off, if I may say so, than the singers of the so-called Golden Age.
There have always been singers who looked good, and some who could act marvellously. You find, if you look back over old reviews, that there were singers who were stars, not so much because they had marvellous voices, but more because of the dramatic use they made of them. But it is fair to say that today, thanks to the cinema, even more to television and video, people probably are more particular about the way singers look. And nature isn't always too careful where she plants the best larynx or voice box or whatever it is that makes the singing voice. American soprano Martina Arroyo, for example, is a lady of a certain size. When interviewed, she's always the first to admit that she needs help from the person who designs her costumes.
I have nothing against famous named designers, but when one will ask Madame so-and-so, who weighs 100 kilos, to put on a brown checkered dress with ruffles, that's ridiculous. I don't care what his name is. And Madame so-and-so might have done as much as she can, but there are very few people that can get away with that sort of capriccio, you know? Mm. Consequently, it's not only for us to remember our responsibility to the audience and to the part, but it's also the responsibility of the designers, not just to try to do something that's different, but there's something that makes sense, that's something that'll present that person at their best. And if they know the person's figure, which is why I always try to send a picture to a designer and say, now look, this is what I'm like. Don't give me a high neck dress because I don't have a neck.
Martina Arroyo, keeping things in perspective. It is not just a matter of size. There are other considerations too.
I never fancied myself as a great actress or a great beauty. I'm afraid I'm one of those born with a rather remarkable gift of a voice.
Joan Sutherland. For many people, one of today's great voices, but not, as she admits herself, quite so greatly gifted when it comes to stage presentation.
It's strange that one doesn't always get everything together. One maybe has the voice, one maybe doesn't have much talent on the stage, but one has to try and improve what one does have as far as voice is concerned and adapt oneself to try and learn something about stagecraft and hope that it's... I think the main thing is to think sincerely and try and get it across by really believing what you're doing.
Sutherland in Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. There can surely, with so much already required, be too much emphasis on how a singer looks, and this can be damaging to opera. You get singers cast in roles for which they're unsuited, just because they look the part, and we sometimes find it difficult to respond to an otherwise first-rate performer who doesn't. But Lord Harwood believes that, even then, we can still believe in the performance.
I mean, for instance, Gigli, Beniamino Gigli, who was a small, on the whole, round fellow with gold in the throat, lots of gold in the throat, a wonderful sound. And one says, oh, he wasn't much of an actor, he didn't act much. Well, he performed a great deal, even in his concerts, but he always reached the audience, he communicated. When I was at school and they'd just issued a recording of Butterfly and Julia was the Pinkerton, and somebody talked about the golden voice, which is completely convincing, the operatic equivalent of stage good looks. And it's a very good remark. If you make the right kind of sound in the right communicative kind of way, you do convey what one assumes is the idea of good looks, of an interesting, attractive partner, so to speak, in a love scene. You do convey precisely that.
Gigli is Pinkerton in Puccini's Madame Butterfly, coaxing his new bride indoors. His butterfly was Toti Del Monte. But it can't always be a Gigli, or for that matter, a Sutherland.
Quite lesser singers, much less famous, who don't make records, are communicators, can reach an audience. And your 20-ton soprano, was it 200 tons, and your small tenor only can't reach rounder, so to speak, may be great communicators, and you may suspend disbelief after the first 5 minutes. You suppress the giggle when they start, and they are so convinced by what they're doing, by the business of putting over this marvelous work, which has lasted for 50, 100, 150 years to the audience. They want to put this over. They're so convinced by what they're doing, they convince you almost immediately.
Commitment like that, it can help even lesser singers and even singers who don't look their parts to get across to audiences and to get the opera across. It's the dramatic side of opera, the acting in opera, that we'll be discussing in the next programme.